Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we'll conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. At this time, I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you, Janitha, and I, too, would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect workshop, Advances in the Treatment of Breast Cancer. And this is a very important topic, and we actually are covering, it's a broad topic, and our speakers are going to address this in very broad ways, and we hope that then you'll be able to ask questions during the Q&A to help to tailor the information to help each of you. Now, today's program is a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and many other cancer organizations. And it really is because of that collaboration that we have so many participants on the call today. So we have over 1,000 participants on the call today. So there are many of you on the call today, and you come from all over the United States. You come from large cities and small cities, from suburban areas as well as rural and frontier communities. And we also have international participants from Canada, China, Guatemala, India, and Indonesia, and the UK. So from all over the world you come, and that's a credit to each of you that you've chosen to spend the next hour with us. I would like to turn your attention to the materials that you have received from Cancer Care. In those materials, there's an outline our speakers have prepared, and there's information about all of the different organizations that have come together to support this program with all of their websites and their toll-free numbers, and I want you to really know that these are all resources for you. There's an extensive resource list for you to use. And there also is an evaluation form in your materials. And I would ask you to take a moment at the end of the program today and please complete that evaluation form. When you think about it, who but each of you can best tell us the topics you would like us to offer in the future? This is the beginning of a new year, and we're planning lots of programs, and so your feedback could not be more timely and more important to us. Indeed, the topic today was one that many of you had asked us to offer, and so here it is. So we try to implement what you ask us to do. Today's activity is supported by an educational donation provided by Amgen, and I really want to thank them for their support of the program today. Now, as you know, we have wonderful faculty on our program today, just wonderful speakers. And I would like to begin by introducing our first speaker, and actually she's back by popular demand, Dr. Ruth Oratz. Dr. Oratz is the Women's Oncology and Wellness Practice. She's an oncologist and specializing in breast cancer. She's Clinical Associate Professor, New York University School of Medicine. And she is going to address overview of breast cancer and current standard of care. I turn the program now over to Dr. Oratz.
Thank you, Carolyn, and it really is my pleasure to participate on these calls. This is a very big topic today, and I thought I would begin with an overview of how we think about treatment for breast cancer. Until very recently, most of our treatment decisions were based whether it was in early stage disease at the time of diagnosis or later on in more advanced stages of disease, our treatment decisions were based on the extent of involvement of the breast cancer. In other words, how large the tumor was, whether or not lymph nodes or other organs were involved. And more recently, we've also incorporated into this idea of extent of disease the biology of the disease, the type of cell that is actually in that individual's breast cancer. And as we've learned over the last several decades, breast cancer is not just one disease, but there are several different subtypes. And these different molecular subtypes correspond to different clinical scenarios so that the different types of breast cancer cells behave differently in the body, and we can target therapies not only based on the location of the tumor or its size, but on targeting what it is biologically that's making those cells grow, that's turning them into malignant cells, and trying to switch off those molecular or biologic signals. And I think that's really been the greatest shift that we've seen in our approach to treating breast cancer. One of the most important differentiating molecular factors in breast cancer is whether or not the cancer is sensitive to hormonal stimulation, and the hormones estrogen and progesterone are the female hormones that stimulate breast cancer cells to grow if the receptors for those hormones are present on the cancer cells, and those are the estrogen ER and progesterone PR. So as many of you have experienced, if the tumor is estrogen or progesterone receptor positive, hormonal therapy is a very important part of treatment. We also know that there's another molecular subtype in which a different receptor, and this receptor is called HER2-NU, which is also a growth factor receptor, if that receptor is present in large amounts on the cancer cell, it also stimulates the cells to grow, and we know that by interfering with the signal to that receptor, or the way that receptor in turn sends a message inside the cell, if we interfere with that molecular pathway by targeting the HER2-NU receptor, we can also have a very effective clinical response. So that's sort of the second big category of cancers. And then there are some cancers that do not express any of these receptors. So they don't have the estrogen or progesterone receptor or the HER2-NU receptor. And in those situations, using targeted biologic treatments are not really helpful. We would have to turn to other therapies, including chemotherapy, and now as our research is progressing, looking for new pathways to really work on those cells that don't express the estrogen, progesterone, or HER2-NU receptors. So this idea of molecular subtypes of breast cancer and trying to target therapies that are appropriate for the individual's type of cancer cell is really very, very important. In the process of making decisions, another important paradigm shift has occurred, I think, and this has happened over decades, and that is having patient participation in what kind of treatment should be the first, second, or third treatment. So certainly as surgeons, radiation oncologists, medical oncologists, we meet with our patients, we talk about what's going on in terms of the extent of disease, and make recommendations based on the type of breast cancer that we see. But there really is a role for input from the patient in helping us, again, tailor therapy that would be appropriate for that individual. One of the, I think, very exciting aspects of treating breast cancer is that we have many, many, many options for very effective therapies. And choosing the right combination of treatments or the right sequence of treatments really does involve this shared decision-making between the doctor and the patient. The new technologies that have impacted this whole process are sometimes called genomics or pharmacogenomics. And that vocabulary refers to the work we're doing now in, again, understanding the molecular subtypes of the cancer cell, but also in having a better understanding of how the different therapeutic agents, the different anti-cancer drugs, whether they are hormonal therapies, chemotherapies, or biologic agents, actually behave in the body. Understanding what makes those drugs active or inactive, and also understanding how those drugs may interact with other medications. So we've been learning a lot about optimizing the way we use our treatments. Now, to turn specifically to what some of the standards of practice are in terms of treatment, I thought I would first review, in broad strokes, hormonal therapy. Again, hormonal therapy is used in both early stage and more advanced stages of breast cancer if the estrogen receptor and or progesterone receptor are present on the cancer cell. The choice of hormonal therapy depends also on the menopausal status of the woman. For premenopausal women, tamoxifen, which binds the estrogen receptor and blocks it, is still the standard of care in most circumstances. Other options for premenopausal women, and these are options that are still being studied to some extent in clinical trials, include suppressing ovarian function medically by using certain drugs that turn off ovarian functions, drugs like Zoladex and Lupron and Triptorelin, either in combination with tamoxifen or an aromatase inhibitor. Some premenopausal women may elect to have their ovaries removed, and this is also a hormonal manipulation that decreases the amount of estrogen in the body and thereby decreasing that estrogen stimulus to the cancer cell to grow. In postmenopausal women, we still have the option of using tamoxifen. It's an excellent treatment. But there are also a number of other drugs that have been used and have been validated as being very efficacious in postmenopausal breast cancer. And those include the aromatase inhibitors, and there are three of those available in the United States and worldwide. Those are anastrozole, letrozole, and exemestane. And we have learned that these drugs, like tamoxifen, are very, very effective, and like tamoxifen, by the way, are oral. So we're talking here about medication that's taken in pill form, very effective in treating hormone-responsive breast cancer. We can use these drugs in sequence and very often have a long duration of response when we use hormonal therapy. Another type of hormonal therapy that's used is a medication that is called Faslodex, and this medicine, fulvestrant, works by actually changing the expression of the estrogen receptor on the cancer cell. This drug is effective in women who are postmenopausal and is a standard of practice used predominantly in the setting of more advanced disease. So we have a number of different hormonal therapies, and again, depending on whether you're pre- or postmenopausal, choices for the ER-PR-positive breast cancers. In addition to hormonal therapy, we have targeted biologic therapy. I mentioned before a very important biologic target called HER2-NU, and until very recently, the best target against HER2-NU was a monoclonal antibody treatment called trastuzumab or Herceptin, and this has been used also in early stage and advanced stages of breast cancer and is very, very effective in treating HER2-positive breast cancer. A newer agent, although we've been using it now for several years, which also has activity against the HER2-NU pathway, is a medication called lapatinib. It's also called Tykerb. This is an oral medicine, again, taken in pill form, and has been shown, particularly in combination with chemotherapy or, in fact, more recently, with certain hormonal therapies, also to be very, very active in treating HER2-positive breast cancer. And some very recent data tells us that the combination of using both trastuzumab and lapatinib together may be also very effective in targeting this particular subtype of breast cancer. Another biologic therapy that we've been using more and more recently targets a different pathway, which is the vascular endothelial growth factor, and the medicine here is bevacizumab or Avastin. This is, again, a monoclonal antibody and has so far been approved for use in more advanced stages of disease in combination with chemotherapy, and Dr. Burstein may talk a little bit about some of the clinical trials going on in earlier stage disease. Now we come to the big topic of chemotherapy. When and why do we use chemotherapy? Chemotherapy is a much less specific treatment than either hormonal therapy or targeted biologic therapy, but is still a mainstay, still a standard of practice in treating breast cancer at all stages. The indications for when and how to use chemotherapy have been changing over the years, and that's a good thing. We want our standards of practice to change as research brings us new information and refines our understanding of how and when to use these agents. There are a vast number of chemotherapy drugs that have efficacy in treating breast cancer, and over the years, based on the results of clinical trials, we've learned how to use these agents either singly or in combination. We've refined the way we calculate doses and the kinds of schedules that can be used, whether it's once a week or daily therapy. Some of the chemo drugs are available in oral form as well, or once every 2 weeks or once every 3 weeks. So we have really a variety of regimens to choose from, again, based on the specific needs of the individual patient, the extent of her disease, her symptoms, and so on. I think overall, for all of us, the goal of treatment is to identify an effective regimen that targets specifically the type of breast cancer that this individual has, and balancing the benefits with the side effects and with the long-term risks. So our goal is to maximize our treatment benefit and minimize toxicity and side effects. And then finally, I'd like to add that there are a whole host of other agents and other directions that we've been looking at now to help support the benefits we get from specific therapies. And this includes looking at nutrition and supplements and vitamins. We've learned recently that obesity contributes both to an increased incidence of breast cancer as well as an increased risk of recurrence. We have also learned that alcohol intake is related to breast cancer incidence and recurrence. We know now that it's important to have adequate levels of vitamin D, and also that some of the medicines that we use for treating other conditions, for example, osteoporosis, when we use the bisphosphonate medications, may be associated not only with improving the bone density, but perhaps in reducing the risk of recurrence of breast cancer. So this is another whole area of research that we are turning our attention to, and as we get more and more information about this, I think we'll see our standards of practice expanding to include much stronger recommendations regarding diet, nutrition, vitamins, supplements, and perhaps even other medicines that weren't initially developed as anti-cancer agents, but which in fact may have a role in helping to prevent or reduce the risk of recurrence. So I'd like to turn over to Dr. Burstein at this point to talk a little bit more about some of the new areas of research and clinical trials, and then we can answer questions about standards of practice later on.
I want to thank you very much, Dr. Oritz, for just a really incredibly informative and encyclopedic review of breast cancer, so that we really, I think this is really excellent to provide this overview for everyone. And thank you very much. And I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A. And our next speaker is Dr. Harold Burstein. Dr. Burstein is Breast Oncology Center, Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, Associate Professor of Medicine, Harvard Medical School. He also is a medical oncologist specializing in breast cancer. And Dr. Burstein is going to talk about new treatment approaches and the role of clinical trials. And he, too, is backed by popular demand. Dr. Burstein?
Well, thanks, Carolyn, and thanks, Ruth. It's always nice to join this group. These are a great series of conferences that have been organized. I thought I'd speak about four or five areas where there's particular excitement and there are new treatment approaches and very important clinical trials ongoing right now nationwide. Let me start by talking about HER2-positive breast cancer, which Ruth already defined for us. As you know, these are tumors, about 15 to 20% of all cancers, that overexpress the HER2 protein. And because we know that that overexpression is a very important event in the origins of these kinds of breast cancers, and we know that targeting HER2 can radically improve the outcomes for patients, this has been an area where there's tremendous research interest. So there are probably four or five small molecule drugs like lapatinib, or so-called Tykerb, and neratinib, which we and others have worked with, and a variety of other drugs that are now coming along which target this HER2 protein and the EGFR so-called receptor, which is also commonly overexpressed in these cells. And what's been seen is that even after prior Herceptin treatment, drugs like lapatinib and to some degree neratinib and others have substantial clinical activity, yielding important responses and improving patient symptoms. So that area has been very fertile, and there is lots of work ongoing. The other drug in this area of HER2-targeted therapy that has generated tremendous enthusiasm in the past year or two has been a derivative of Herceptin called T-DM1, or trastuzumab DM1. And this is a very interesting compound because what the manufacturers at Genentech have done has been to take an old flavor of chemotherapy, a drug called DM1, which is a maytansine flavor of chemotherapy that was studied by the National Cancer Institute in the 1970s. By itself, the drug had limited activity, and it was very toxic. What the researchers at Genentech have been able to do has been to take a very small amount of that drug and link it chemically to the antibody, which is the trastuzumab antibody, or Herceptin. So the result is a combination product of an antibody which has fused to it several molecules of this very potent chemotherapy. And what has been fascinating to see is that, again, in patients who previously have had Herceptin-based treatment, offering them T-DM1 as part of a clinical trial has meant dramatic responses in many, many patients, even though they've previously had lots of anti-HER2 therapy. And this is really going to open the door to a next generation of anti-HER2 trials, first in metastatic breast cancer patients, and then already on the drawing board now for early-stage patients with HER2-positive breast cancer. And here's a really nice thing about this new compound. It doesn't make your hair fall out. How's that for a great combination of chemotherapy and a biological therapy? So that HER2-positive breast cancer space is an area where there really is a lot of exciting stuff going on, and knowing the marker has allowed the drug companies and the investigators to move very quickly. A second area where there is great promise has been the development of a class of drugs which are called PARP inhibitors, P-A-R-P. And I confess, I forget exactly what that acronym stands for. But the PARP enzyme is one of the enzymes very much involved in DNA repair. One of the things that distinguishes normal cell function is its ability to repair the DNA, which might get damaged along the way in the life of a cell. In fact, one of the things that many chemotherapy drugs do is they actually work by damaging DNA. And there has been a lot of preclinical data to suggest that if you could impair this ability to repair the DNA, that the cancer cells might undergo so-called programmed cell death or apoptosis or just die because they couldn't adequately repair their DNA. So this past year, we had two proof-of-principle observations with PARP inhibitors that were really quite astonishing. One was a study that looked at triple-negative breast cancers. This is, a minority of breast cancer patients, 15 to 20% of breast cancer patients, but historically a group that has been tougher to treat where there are fewer targeted options because they're not candidates for drugs like Herceptin or anti-estrogen therapies. In this study, they compared chemotherapy alone versus chemotherapy with one of these PARP inhibitors from a company called Bipar, which was subsequently bought by Sanofi. And in that study, they showed that adding the PARP inhibitor improved the activity of the chemotherapy. It improved the response rate to the combination. It improved the period of tumor control and actually enhanced overall survival. So that was a small randomized trial that really whetted people's appetite for this class of drugs, and there has now been a large national phase 3 study run by the drug company comparing that same chemotherapy regimen with or without the addition of a PARP inhibitor, again for triple-negative breast cancers. And that study is just wrapping up accrual in a remarkably short period of time, and we hope to see data within a year or so on that. The second proof-of-principle study for PARP inhibitors was from a very select group of breast cancer patients. This was the group of women who had hereditary breast cancer with known BRCA1 or BRCA2 mutations. And one of the interesting things about the biology of BRCA1 and 2 is that, again, those are proteins involved in DNA repair. So the thinking here was that if you used a PARP inhibitor, that you might also double hit that DNA repair strategy. And so what the company AstraZeneca did was run a global trial for women who have advanced breast cancer and are known to have BRCA1 or 2 mutations, and they showed that their drug, which is called olaparib, could also cause dramatic responses in such patients. So two very exciting proof-of-principle observations for this very new class of drugs. And the PARP inhibitors have now, there are about a half dozen of them in development from different pharmaceutical companies. There are studies going on at many of the major cancer centers around the country. And this is really an area that is just exploding all within the past 6 or 12 months. Very, very exciting research. The third area I wanted to speak to was in management of earlier stage breast cancer, and that really is the area of molecular diagnostics. So for the majority of women who have estrogen receptor positive, HER2-negative breast cancers, we've often wondered how much they really need treatment beyond anti-estrogen therapy. How much do they really need chemotherapy in particular to help prevent the cancer from coming back? And we have been hamstrung because it's been very hard historically to prove which women really warranted chemotherapy and which did not. Now, one of the big advances in the past 3 or 4 years has been the development of an assay called the Oncotype DX test, which many of you may be familiar with, and many of you may have even had performed on your cancers. But that test appears to distinguish which women really benefit from adding chemotherapy to hormone treatments and which women, by contrast, really don't benefit because their tumors just don't need the chemotherapy. And there is an ongoing study at the national level called the TAILOR-RX trial, which is going to be over 10,000 women prospectively treated using an algorithm based on the Oncotype DX assay to decide whether or not to give chemotherapy or, if you're in a quandary, to randomize the patient to chemotherapy or not. And that, too, in the next few years is going to really prove to be a landmark study in the sense of telling us which patients most need chemotherapy and which do not. So those are just some of the exciting areas that are leading to new treatment approaches. And before I wrap up my remarks, I really want to give a plug for the importance of clinical trials. It turns out that the way we learn things, the way the field moves forward in breast cancer medicine, is through prospective, usually randomized, clinical trials. When we say things like tamoxifen works or chemotherapy works or Herceptin's a great drug, we know that because of women who have participated in clinical trials where some of them got one treatment and some got another, and we followed them for long periods of time, and we are able to say with great confidence, this drug helps this much. And that is an extraordinary accomplishment for the research community, for the advocacy community, and of course for the contributions of the cancer patients. But now more than ever, this is really the golden era of clinical investigation in breast cancer. There are a dozen different molecular diagnostic tests being evaluated. There are truly dozens of drugs, angiogenesis inhibitors, PARP inhibitors, next-generation anti-HER2 drugs, all sorts of classes of drugs coming forward. And if you're getting care at a center that is not participating in some of these exciting clinical trials, then they are missing out on an opportunity to really share in some of the excitement of the research that's happening. And you might be missing out on some access to what are undoubtedly going to be the drugs of the future. And it's hard to convey this in a teleconference, but when you go to the cancer meetings right now, there is a sense that this is the best time ever to be involved in clinical investigation, both as an investigator and arguably as a patient as well. And I hope that that'll be a big part of your thinking about your care should the opportunity arise or the need arise. So with that, I'll finish my remarks and join you again at the Q&A.
I want to thank you very much, Dr. Burstein, for really an excellent, just a very excellent presentation, and really the importance of your highlighting the importance of clinical trials. And you really did make the point, and I so appreciate that. That's so important for everybody to think about participating in research trials and being at centers and talking to your healthcare team about this. And the concept that this is the golden era, that is a very important one for all of us to take with us as a takeaway from this call, as well as many other concepts. So thank you very much, Dr. Burstein. I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A. Our next speaker is Dr. Jenna Rosa Grana. Dr. Grana is a medical oncologist specializing in breast cancer. She's director of breast cancer program, Cooper Hospital, UMC, associate professor of medicine, University of Medicine and Dentistry of New Jersey, Robert Wood Johnson School of Medicine. She, too, is here by popular demand. She has spoken on a number of our programs. And Dr. Grana is going to address tips for managing side effects and pain and communicating with your healthcare team. Dr. Grana.
Good morning, Carolyn. It's a pleasure to be here. I believe that the topic I've been given really fits in together as an entity. Managing side effects and pain and communicating with your healthcare team are intertwined. We think of breast cancer as a disease that requires a multidisciplinary approach, and that involves a team of individuals that will work with you on your diagnosis and treatment. It includes an oncologist, a surgeon, a radiation oncologist, sometimes nursing, nutrition, genetics, psychological support, etc. And the idea is to communicate well with this team, and the communication needs to involve both the patient, the family, and the team, because the other important thing we know about breast cancer is that it's not just a disease that affects the woman, it's a disease that has repercussions on the entire family. When dealing with that team, it's important to have open discussions that cover a variety of topics that you've heard about already. What is the standard of care for your particular diagnosis versus clinical trials? Your team should be able to give you information regarding that. What's the role of a second opinion? Your team should be very comfortable with you seeking a second opinion if you desire one, and anyone who is comfortable with their own expertise feels comfortable when a patient seeks a second opinion. Is there a role for preoperative chemotherapy in your care? And if there is a role for preoperative chemotherapy, meaning chemotherapy prior to surgery, why is it being considered in your case? What are the goals? Is the goal to preserve the breast? Is the goal to make the final surgery easier? Again, a thorough discussion needs to revolve around that. I believe that that team also needs to have a thorough understanding and discussion of cases where there is a hereditary aspect to the disease. There are families where there is a clear genetic pattern. Genetic testing may and should be considered because that may impact on the surgical decisions the patient is making at the original time of diagnosis, and it may also make an impact on future management for that patient as well as future management for their family members. So again, the open discussion with the team needs to encompass this. And finally, the discussion also needs to cover areas of fertility. A woman needs to be, along with her partner, able to discuss with that initial team what her interests are in long-term fertility. We're now seeing increasing numbers of young women that have not yet had children that clearly have an interest in future fertility. And that discussion needs to happen at time of diagnosis so that issues such as egg harvesting, potentially using agents to suppress the ovaries during chemotherapy or other strategies can be considered. It's not always possible to ensure fertility. It's not always possible to delay chemotherapy to allow for egg harvesting. But again, you don't know if you haven't brought it up for discussion and if your team has not recognized that this is an important issue for you. Having said that, let's move next to side effects that we grapple with during treatment, and I want to break that down into side effects of chemotherapy, side effects of hormonal therapy, and other. As you've heard, the number of drugs that we are now using to treat breast cancer has really increased dramatically. The common side effects such as nausea, neuropathy, hand-foot syndrome, cardiac issues are all things that we are now better than ever able to care for in a woman getting chemotherapy. So your team really will work with you to find the drugs that will help control each of those things, or sometimes not even drugs, but simply some local measures or some interventions that can help. But more and more as we look at new drugs in the treatment of breast cancer, we think of Avastin. We're now being asked to manage hypertension, to manage nosebleeds and other toxicity. And the key to managing the side effects of chemotherapy is to communicate with your team that you are having these side effects. They can't help you if they don't know that it's happening. And also to communicate with them the strategies that are helping or not so that other strategies can be added. Hormonal therapy, although it's a wonderful approach to treatment of breast cancer, has its own issues. It has the hot flashes and night sweats that many women deal with. Not only are they brought on by early onset of menopause that chemotherapy can cause, but they're also brought on by the hormonal therapies that we use, tamoxifen, aromatase inhibitors. We also have the vaginal symptoms that can occur because of this and the effect on libido. It's a common complaint that women tell you their sexuality is different. And again, your health team needs to be open to a frank discussion about these issues, because if you don't discuss it and they're not receptive to it, you won't be able to find strategies to help you deal with these issues. Another issue with the hormonal therapy tends to be arthritic symptoms. We see that a large number of women that are on aromatase inhibitors, a fewer number of women who are on tamoxifen, will complain of arthritic symptoms that can be quite debilitating. And again, there are things that can be done to alleviate those symptoms, but sometimes it's just reassuring to know that this is normal. This is not metastasis from your breast cancer. This is a side effect of these drugs. And finally, we need to think about depression and anxiety, because for many women, particularly as they come to the end of their chemotherapy, this is an issue that surfaces in a very big way. And there are many treatments that are effective. Counseling is effective for some women, support groups. Your healthcare team may actually have access to psychologists or others that can work with you in addition to giving you medical therapy to help deal with this. And again, it's very common and is often reassuring to the woman to recognize that she's not going crazy, that this is not just her. This is a common thing. In addition to these things we've talked about, you heard about the bisphosphonates as drugs that can be used to prevent some of the long-term issues with the treatment of breast cancer. We know the hormonal agents can cause osteoporosis or increase the risk of osteoporosis, and we now have some potential drugs that we use to prevent that. So your team will work with you to manage bone. Your team will also work with you to address nutritional strategies, because, again, we're learning that more and more nutrition may play a role, and there are things that you can do that may alter your risk of recurrence and that may be beneficial. So the message that I conclude with is that it's vital for you to communicate with that team. They can't know the things that you don't share with them, and a good team is open to all of these discussions and shouldn't be hesitant to discuss them with you. And I'll stop there.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Grana, for excellent presentation, very outstanding. And actually, we, having heard our three physician speakers, this is a winning team here, but having the right team of physicians clearly is very important. And also what you've discussed in terms of just the management of all of the side effects and the working very closely with the healthcare team. So thank you so much. And I know there'll be questions about this during the Q&A, and thank you. And thank you for your great passion about the need to manage these side effects. It's so important that it's possible to do this. Our next speaker, and our final speaker, is Patricia Spicer. And Pat Spicer is an oncology social worker. She's breast cancer program coordinator for Cancer Care. And Pat is going to review with you some of the services that you can access for free from Cancer Care. Pat?
Thank you, Carolyn. This was an absolutely wonderful meeting, not just because it talked about advances in treatment, but because it also addressed quality of life issues. And I think one of the most important things that women can do to help themselves along their treatment pathway is to become educated consumers. Make it a point to talk to your doctor about questions or concerns you have about your treatment. And I know not everybody is close to a major cancer center. Some people depend on local community hospitals, but have the conversation with your doctor so that he or she can look up or can research for you concerns about your own questions. If you have questions or concerns, or as we were just informed, many people at the end of treatment are more distressed than they were at the beginning, and a great deal of my practice or the questions that come up in my breast cancer support groups are about, why do I feel so terrible now when I was doing so well at the beginning, and now that my treatment is over, I feel worse. Don't let it go. Get help, and one of the things that we at Cancer Care can do is to offer that help. We offer support groups both online and telephone and in face-to-face settings. We also offer individual counseling, and our oncology social workers can help you address these questions and offer suggestions that will help. To access us online, you can go to www.cancercare.org or by toll-free telephone to 1-800-813-4673. And we are available 9 to 5 Eastern Standard Time. Please feel free to call us. Our services are free of charge, and we have information, fact sheets, and booklets that we can send to you, and an oncology social worker will be glad to address your questions either by phone or online. Thank you, Carolyn.
Well, thank you very much, Pat, and really for making all those services accessible to people so they understand what they can access, and for your highlighting the significance of quality of life during treatment. That's so important. And now we have time for questions. We have a lot of time for questions, and I'm going to ask Trinitha to bring all of our speakers on board, open all their lines, and would you please explain to the audience how to queue up for questions one at a time, and we're going to take as many of your questions as possible. If we do not get to your question, you know you can just call Cancer Care after the call. We have 60 master's level trained oncology social workers here to help you. So, of course, if we don't get to your question, please do call our 1-800-813-HOPE number after the call. Trinitha, could you explain to people how to queue up and ask their questions?
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press star then one on your touch tone telephone. Our first question is from Gail C. Go ahead, please.
How long is the recommended time a person should take Arimidex? If my doctor says only for 5 years, how do I get a prescription for longer? I noted some trials are going on 9 years.
Thank you for that question, Gail. I'm going to ask Dr. Orath if she could address that question.
Yes. Right now, our standard of practice for using aromatase inhibitors in the adjuvant setting, that is in early-stage breast cancer, is for 5 years of treatment. We have some clinical trials that are looking at prolonged hormonal therapy. Most of those studies are looking at sequencing tamoxifen followed by an aromatase inhibitor, so that would be 5 years of tamoxifen followed by 5 years of an AI, or 2 to 3 years of tamoxifen followed by 2 to 3 years of an aromatase inhibitor. The question of whether to use aromatase inhibitors for longer than 5 years is an open question and is, as of right now, not our standard of practice. So we would not be writing prescriptions for you beyond year five unless we had clinical trials data that told us that that was something we should be doing.
Excellent. Thank you very much. Excellent question, Gail. Our next question, please.
Thank you. Our next question is from Stephanie K. Go ahead, please.
Yes. Hello, everybody. Thank you so much for this seminar. I have peripheral neuropathy, very severe in my hands and feet, more so in my hands from the Taxol that I was on over 2 years ago for 8 weeks. And my doctor constantly says it's not going to get better, and all she says is you could take Neurontin, which I tried. It's not good. And I did try alpha-lipoic and B6, which I'm taking. And I also have chemo brain. So I have major things that I'm going through. And I'd like to ask the doctors, what are they doing with the peripheral neuropathy and chemo brain?
Thank you. That's an excellent question, Stephanie. I'm going to ask Dr. Grana to address your question in a general way so everyone can get help with that. I know that's an issue that many people are concerned about. Dr. Grana, could you address that?
I think that's a very good question. The issue of chemo brain has been the subject of a lot of research, and the question is it just chemotherapy? Is it the onset of menopause? Is it the hormonal therapy that we're giving? Or is it a combination of all of those things? Clearly, it's been demonstrated that if you test women and do neurocognitive testing, you can document that there are deficits in women after chemotherapy. A year later, they still exist. 2 years later, they've gotten better, but they haven't gone away. So I think this is something we encounter. What can you do for this? I think the most important thing you can do for this is recognize that it's there. In women where it's severe, I've sent them for neurocognitive testing so that they can then, in addition to the recognition of how severe it is, they can actually have some strategies given as to how to cope with the deficits. And sometimes there are medications that can be used depending on what the areas there are. Some of the things such as Ritalin or other that can be used by neuropsychologists to deal with some of these issues. So it is a real problem for some individuals, and I think reassurance, it does tend to get better over time, but there are things you can do to compensate.
Carolyn, some of the women in my group have developed some techniques for dealing with some of the chemo brain issues, including making lists and keeping them in a prominent place, always putting car keys or house keys in the same spot Some women have tagged them with red so that they can find them quickly. And other women have told us that engaging in meditation where they are relaxed has helped them to with memory recall. And one of the other things they've done has taken up crossword puzzles, jigsaw puzzles, things that require mental stimulation to help control some of the chemo brain.
Excellent. And Stephanie, we at Cancer Care have a number of materials on this topic. And also joining a support group or speaking to a social worker, I'd like to talk with you after the call because I think there are a lot of resources out there. And I think Dr. Grana also has identified some excellent resources as well in terms of really getting a handle on this. And I know for many of you struggling with this. We have done a number of programs on this topic, so you will see them on the website as podcasts. On we call the memory and thinking changes, as well as on peripheral neuropathy. Dr. Guana, did you just want to comment on peripheral neuropathy as well?
That is a real issue for some women, and I don't agree that it doesn't get better. I think time does help most of these things, but it is worth talking and potentially seeing someone who deals with pain management syndromes because there are things beyond Neurontin that can be tried. There are other types of antidepressants that can be used that can be helpful in this, and so I would discuss it with someone else. I would see someone in a pain management setting.
And on our other programs, we have sometimes used physicians of rehabilitation medicine mm-hmm. who've offered tremendous recommendations in terms of assessing the neuropathy and then recommending a course in terms of helping with that. So, there, I think as Dr. Grana said, there are many things that one can consider in just getting a handle on it. And I think, as Pat said, in learning to compensate for these things, if they're going to be there, how do you deal with them on a day-to-day basis? And that's really very important to get that help for everyone on the call. Anything that's there that you're having trouble with, we want to be sure that's quality of life issues that you get that support with. And I would definitely encourage you to use the staff here at Cancer Care as a start. Our next question.
Thank you. Our next question is from Denise Kay. Go ahead, please.
Hi. Good afternoon. Great program. Thank you. I'd like to know what are the newest advances in terms of radiation treatment. We haven't really touched on that topic today.
Excellent point. Thank you, Denise. That's an excellent question. Dr. Orris or Dr. Burstein, do you want to address that or both?
Sure. Thank you for bringing that up, and that was an oversight on our part not to include radiation therapy. Radiation therapy has many, many uses in treating breast cancer. In the primary treatment of breast cancer, it is used adjunctively after segmental excision or lumpectomy. And there are a number of protocols that are now being used across the country. The standard radiation protocol has been for between 5 and 6 weeks of treatment with a boost to the tumor bed, treatment daily, Monday through Friday, 5 days a week, and then an additional boost to where the tumor was in the breast. However, there are now emerging data from studies done in Canada, in Europe, and also in the U.S. that we can start using more abbreviated courses of treatment, three-week protocols where there's a slightly higher dose delivered with each fraction, but the entire treatment is finished in 3 weeks rather than 6 weeks. There's also some investigation looking at partial breast radiation, particularly for very small tumors that are widely excised with wide margins, and brachytherapy or delivering radiation therapy through a balloon catheter directly into the tumor tissue itself. Again, in selected patient populations, this can also be very effective. So we are seeing changes in our standards of practice with respect to radiation therapy as well as systemic treatment for breast cancer.
Thank you. Our next question, please.
Thank you. Our next question is from Karen S. Go ahead, please.
Thank you for a wonderful presentation. I'm wondering if it would be possible for you to speak about how many clinical trials are currently underway and when will results be available related to the possible benefits of bifosphonates in terms of potentially reducing the risk of recurrence.
Dr. Burstein, would you want to address that?
Sure.
Sure. So there are hundreds of trials underway with various drugs and various stages of disease, and we're very fortunate that there's an excellent resource for these. Almost all of the important trials are registered by the federal government, and if you go to www.clinicaltrials.gov, G-O-V, you will find a really excellent list, which you can then search with keywords or phrases or your favorite type of drug or other observations. And this is a very up-to-date and valuable resource from the National Institutes of Health. With respect to the bisphosphonates, we saw one result from a study called the ABCSG12 trial published about a year ago in the New England Journal of Medicine. This was a study of young women who did not receive chemotherapy, which suggested that there was a small benefit for adding bisphosphonates. Most of us thought those data were tantalizing, but still a little bit premature. There are two specific trials that most of the research community is waiting upon. One is a study called the AZUR trial, A-Z-U-R-E, which is a drug company study from Novartis looking at Zometa as a adjuvant therapy for breast cancer. The other is a study from the NSABP with a drug called clodrinate, which is an orally available bisphosphonate. Those studies closed to accrual over a year ago, and in fact, many years ago, and we have been waiting for the data. Presumably, we are waiting because there are relatively few breast cancer recurrences, which is always good news, but it means that the study has not had the number of events they need to allow them to report their results. So we've been saying they'd be available in 6 to 12 months, but we've been saying that for the past 2 or 3 years, so we're still waiting. But I think that truly within the next year or two, there is the expectation that we'll have more data on that question.
Carolyn, there's another good site if you're looking for clinical trials. It's Emerging Med, and it's called it's at www.emergingmed.org, and they will actually do a search and match you to a clinical trial that you might be interested in, both you and your doctor.
Excellent. Thank you. And for those of you who might not have computer access easily, you can call the National Cancer Institute at 1-800-4-CANCER. And that's actually in all your materials as well. These are wonderful resources for you to get additional information about everything in addition to clinical trials. So I would say, when in doubt, do call those numbers. That's really helpful. Our next question, please.
Thank you. Our next question is from Lori S. Go ahead, please.
Hello.
Hi, Lori. Your question?
Yes, I had a question about the clinical trial about, I think this is what it is, TDM1. Adding DM1 to Herceptin. And I wanted to know if it's being done for clinical trials for early stage breast cancer patients, or is it only now for advanced stage?
This is Hal. So at the moment, TDM1 is only being explored in metastatic breast cancer. There are discussions ongoing to figure out how best to incorporate that drug into treatment options for early stage women, and I would not be surprised if those trials began in the next year or so, but for the moment, it's only being studied in women who have metastatic disease.
I have to say this is an outstanding audience. Great questions. Our next question, please.
Thank you. Our next question is from Amy W. Go ahead, please.
Hi. Yes, I had some questions about any studies that are being done on complementary treatments along with, you know, the standard protocols that you've already talked about. I'm thinking specifically, you mentioned nutrition, but I'm also thinking specifically with acupuncture and yoga and meditation, those types of alternatives or complementary, I'd like to think of them better, modalities.
Excellent. Thank you for that question. Amy, Dr. Oritz, do you want to address that?
Sure. We have seen a number of studies that have been published in the medical oncology literature that have demonstrated benefits to patients using these complementary modalities, particularly acupuncture, meditation, and yoga, in terms of helping to improve overall sense of well-being, tolerate treatment with fewer side effects, and I think, as we heard earlier, even to help with some specific side effects, such as chemo brain. I think, you know, it's difficult to really run big randomized clinical trials that are going to show us a major effect, but my sense from the data that we have seen and from the patients who I have worked with is that anything you do that helps you feel better is good. And for some women, that will be exercise, and that may be vigorous exercise if women are up to that and are accustomed to that. For other women, it may be a more gentle form of exercise. But exercise overall and movement overall is very helpful. It helps to improve the general sense of well-being. It helps to maintain an ideal body weight, and we know that obesity is not a good thing. For women who are experiencing joint pain and discomfort related to menopausal symptoms or the use of some of the hormonal agents, moving helps. So I think that certainly has been established. We know that acupuncture can help for women who have nausea associated with chemotherapy and even some of the other pain syndromes, perhaps even peripheral neuropathy. So I think we are seeing more and more academic centers setting up programs for patients to participate in these kinds of complementary activities. Establishing real causal effects is going to be difficult.
There was also a small study presented at San Antonio this year on meditation and its effect on women dealing with quality of life issues.
Yes.
That seemed very promising. A lot of my patients use Tai Chi. They find it relaxing because the movements are soft and gentle if they're experiencing any pain as a result of being on the aromatase inhibitors. They find it easier to do. And many of my patients use yoga or guided meditation to help not only with nausea or but with anxiety and with quality of life issues. Those seem to be the most popular ones, and they seem to be very efficacious.
Okay. Our next question, please.
Thank you. Our next question is from Gail Kay. Go ahead, please.
Oh, I was very interested in hearing you say something about drugs for osteoporosis might be a helping. What other kinds of things like that are they beginning to find out in studies?
Dr. Perstein, could you address that?
Well, there's a lot of interest in trying to figure out if a variety of other sort of lifestyle interventions or commonly used drugs for other purposes might be helpful. There have been preclinical reasons to think that drugs like metformin, which is used to treat diabetes, might have anti-cancer effects or vitamin supplements or things. For the most part, those observations have not borne great fruit. There are not a lot of data that tweaking vitamin intake or other medicines used for other purposes are going to have a major impact in breast cancer. What they continue to be interested in are looking at large observational data sets from, for instance, the Women's Health Study or similar studies where they have data on millions of, and they have all their medical information. They have things on dietary consumption, alcohol and food consumption, over-the-counter medicines, prescription medicines, and they continue to drill very hard into these data to see if they can find clues to suggest where to go next. For the moment, the bisphosphonates are obviously a lead candidate, and it's hard to point to another class of drugs used for other purposes that are emerging as potentially anti-cancer drugs, though you never want to say never.
I want to thank all of our speakers. You have been outstanding. This has been an extraordinary call. I want to thank all of you. I want to thank all of you who've queued up and asked such wonderful questions. Really, your questions really enhance the call. And I also want to thank all of you who've been listening. This has been a very large call, over 1,000 participants. And I want to remind all of you that this is a one-hour program, and that in planning a program like this, we know that you have many needs that go far beyond the scope of one-hour program. With that in mind, I want you all to know that you can access all the services of Cancer Care by calling the organization 1-800-813-HOPE and visiting our website, and also all the resources that you have in your materials. Most importantly, I don't want anyone to feel that you're alone in the conclusion of this call. I don't want you to think that you have to cope with everything by yourself. You're now part of the community of support. Please contact Cancer Care, use our staff here, and really, and don't feel that you have to do this all by yourself. There's a lot of people to help you. I want to thank you all for participating today, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes. the workshop. You may disconnect and have a wonderful day.